How would you like to attend a conference and hear Larry Rast, Carl Fakencher, Brian Wolfmiller, Adrian Dorheinz, Will Wheaton, Chris Roseborough, and Jonathan Fisk? You're invited to the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 10th and 11th in Collinsville, Illinois. Registration is $100. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 10th and 11th in Collinsville, Illinois. issuesetc.org.
How is he?
Luther's depressed, my lord. Confused. He feels the peasants have twisted his language.
But he will join them.
Luther abhors violence.
But he's in sympathy with their grievances.
It's hard to argue against freeing people from crippling taxes or the purgatory of being bond slaves all their lives.
Oh. You know, if Luther were to lift one finger, every peasant in Germany would rise up behind him.
Maybe. Luther's a theologian, my lord. He fights, but with his tongue or his pen. He will not draw the sword.
That's a fictional scene from the 2003 Luther movie discussing the reformer Martin Luther and the peasants' war between Frederick the Wise and Spalatin. Now, Luther was deeply concerned about the peasant uprising, and it's something that required a lot of his attention, and yes, a lot of his speech and a lot of his writing. We're going to be talking about that period of the Reformation, the Peasants' War, and on a happier note a little bit later in our conversation, Luther's marriage to Catherine von Bora, part 16 of our weekly series on Martin Luther and the Reformation. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. We're coming to you from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. After our first hour and the second hour of the program, Pastor Matt Harrison will be our guest. We're going to be listening to his presentation at the 2014 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. He'll be making the case for confessional Lutheranism in the 21st century. Dr. Ken Sherb is a regular guest. He joins us for the 16th part of our weekly series on Martin Luther and the Reformation. We'll discuss the Peasants' War and Luther's marriage. He's pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri. He has a PhD in history from Ohio State University and formerly served as a theology professor at Concordia University, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Ken, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Number 16, we are racking these things up.
Well, last time we were talking about those years, 1523, 1526, somewhere in there, where really what we're looking at in those years is Luther's work on the liturgy and his hymnody. We talked extensively about that. But there were other things, I mean, big things, the kind of things that make it into history books going on at this time. What else do we need to know about those years?
Well, there is so much happening during these years that, Todd, we're actually going to need the next several programs even to begin to try to trace everything. And we should be aware, right going in, that by doing what we will do, that is, identifying various strands or themes in the history and kind of tracing them out one by one, program by program, by doing that, we are already standing at something of a remove from Luther. Because, of course, he didn't have the luxury of separating these things out the way we are. He was taking these things up and responding to them all pretty much simultaneously. I mean, Todd, if you and I think we got a lot of balls to juggle in the air today, think about the array of balls that Luther had going at this time. So, just for today, I think we should start with this reminder. Theological thoughts are always thought, theological truths are always proclaimed in the midst of real, that is, honest-to-goodness, dirt-under-the-fingernails life. While Luther is preaching and lecturing and writing books and reforming the liturgy and composing hymns, a great social upheaval, which had been in the making for years, finally came to a head, namely the German Peasants' War, which came to a head in 1525. And by the way, another bit of real life from almost exactly the same time was that the former friar, Martin Luther, got married at the age of 41.
Now, before we get too far down that road, just remind us a little review of what we talked about last time.
After Luther returned to Wittenberg, he was pastorally concerned to communicate the gospel to lay people in ways that they could access, ways that they could understand, including, of course, his sermons, and, for those who could read it, a personal prayer book. Luther dispensed with the prayer called the Canon of the Mass that spoke of a re-sacrifice of Christ in the Lord's Supper, and Luther revised the order of the communion service along gospel-centered lines, again aimed at serving the common people in his Latin Mass of 1523 and his German Mass of 1526. And Luther himself began to write and encouraged others also to write hymns in the vernacular that emphasized the saving gospel message of the Scriptures.
So how are we going to approach our conversation today, Ken?
Well, this segment and the next will be on the Peasants' War and Luther's response to it. This was not just something going on outside Luther's window while he had his nose buried in a book or something. Luther was deeply concerned, if only because the peasants said that they got some of their stuff, some of their protests, from him. And we will not fail, as we go here, Todd, to notice what a variety of people have said about Luther as a result of his writing and his actions concerning the Peasants' War. And then, in a very different vein, but again, contemporaneous with the war crisis going on at just the same time, Luther got engaged and married to a former nun, Catherine von Bora. And we'll talk about that before we're finished here today.
What were the causes of the Peasants' War in the mid-1520s there?
Well, it's a hard question. The precise causes still actually prove controversial among historians. To speak in terms of the big picture here, Todd, and to try to avoid getting caught up in the kind of details that you'd really need an economic historian, not me, to address, the European economy in general was, at this time, lurching out of the feudalism of the Middle Ages and moving into the capitalism that characterizes modern times. A barter system was giving way to the exchange of cash. And the peasants of all people, were getting squeezed by this. But not only the peasants.
Who else?
Well, for one, the people who used to be small or medium-scale feudal lords. See, they now needed cash. And so they demanded from the peasant farmers that they worked with payments, cash payments, for what used to be held in common, things like access to firewood and pastures, or the right to hunt and fish. And having to make these payments squeezed the peasants still more. So, in general, the resources on which the peasants could live kept dwindling. At a time when the entire population was dwindling. And under the circumstances, some people migrated to the cities, which actually just made things worse for the folks who left themselves out on the land. Now, you take that and you add in some political and legal issues, and you have growing social unrest threatening to come into outright conflict. And these complaints came to a head during the mid-1520s.
How did that happen?
Not immediately with open rebellion or actual violence. Really something more like strikes, as we would call them, or public demonstrations in the late spring of 1524, something on the order of civil disobedience. And then there were outbreaks of real violence during the rest of 1524 and the first few months of 1525, even as various alliances of peasants were forming across regions. In a way, this peasant reaction spread through German lands like waves. That's one way to think of it. Another way to think of it is like a growing spider web. Either way, though, it seemed ominous to the rulers and to anyone else who was concerned with the threat of sedition.
Now, Luther is no fan of sedition. Remind us what he had said on the subject.
Yeah, quite right. He had written already from the Wartburg. He preached when he got back to Wittenberg that he was totally against sedition. Luther distinguished between God's right-hand rule, which basically came through the church and dealt with matters of sin and grace, and God's left-hand rule, which was expressed through the government and dealt with things like marriage, family, public morality. God rules the world in these two ways simultaneously, but the distinction between the two had to be well observed. You had to distinguish between the statutes of law, on the one hand, and, on the other hand, the proclamation of sin and grace for human salvation. And Luther said making that distinction, upholding that distinction, was the best way to avoid a meltdown.
Now, in that matter, and in many others, of course, Luther differed radically from one of his earliest self-proclaimed followers, that of Thomas Munzer. Tell us about him.
And Thomas Munzer was a preacher who provoked some kind of public outburst just about wherever he went. At about the time Luther was at Worms in 1521, Munzer was getting himself kicked out of the city of Zwickau, where Luther had originally recommended him, by the way, for fighting the city council and disrupting other pastors as they tried to preach. Munzer briefly went to Bohemia and made contact with the Hussites. He told them, God has hired me for this harvest, and he thought it was a harvest that would bring destruction to the wicked. Munzer was a mystic. He even advised Luther and Melanchthon that they too should learn to prophesy, like he did. He wanted a spirit-led cleansing of the godless. Well, he came back from Bohemia to German lands. By 1525, he became a local leader of the peasants in their uprising. Against, by the way, the advice of Karlstadt, who wrote and told Munzer just to trust in God. Munzer insisted that the kingdom of God was at hand, and he said that the prince's bullets would be caught in the sleeves of his coat. At a glance, Munzer symbolizes the kind of theologian who played to the crowds, played to the peasants with tragic results. At a deeper level, so intent was he on the unpredictable work of the Holy Spirit, and so committed was he to spiritual purity that he could find nothing that could reliably bring about constructive change in society or church. He was, in effect, a reformer without a church. Not even God's word would do. This is a recipe for destruction.
Dr. Ken Sherb is our guest. Part 16 of our weekly series on Martin Luther and the Reformation. We're talking about the Peasants' War, and a little bit later, Luther's marriage to Catherine von Bora. Dr. Ken Sherb is pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the theologically oriented demands made by the peasants. Stay tuned.
Coming this Easter Sunday, sacred music for the Easter season, LutheranPublicRadio.org. Lutheran Public Radio, sacred music for the world, coming Easter Sunday at LutheranPublicRadio.org.
How do we keep teenagers connected to the church after confirmation? The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March is Teaching the Faith at Home. What does this mean? How is this done? It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. Teaching the Faith at Home costs $15.99 plus shipping and handling. The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March, Teaching the Faith at Home.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
It was the day after Christmas in 1538 when family and friends who were gathered around Luther's table heard him say, "There is no finer gift that a parent can give to a child than an education in the liberal arts." For over 100 years, St. Paul's Lutheran School in Brookfield, Illinois, has been emphasizing the six chief parts and the seven liberal arts, providing classical education in the Lutheran tradition. Visit our website at spbrookfield.org or call 708-485-0650.
Even if your child has mild to moderate autism, learning disabilities, attention difficulties, or other learning challenges, he can receive a classical Christian education. The Simply Classical curriculum was created by Issues Etc. guest Cheryl Swope, an author, educator with a master's degree in special education, and homeschooling mother of twins with special needs. The Simply Classical curriculum has become an answer to prayer for parents and schools. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and save $5 with the coupon code LPR.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Tuesday, March the 22nd, we're continuing our series on Martin Luther and the Reformation with Dr. Ken Sherb, talking about the Peasants' War and Luther's marriage. Ken, let's talk about the demands that the peasants were making. You were talking about many of their grievances. What were some of the theologically oriented demands made by the peasants?
Yeah, they were making demands that had a theological edge to them. Many of the peasants thought that Luther's protest was really linked with their own cause. And this came out near the beginning of 1525 in a manifesto, 12 articles, where the peasants were demanding certain things. And their first demand was the demand to choose their own pastors. More broadly, they said they should not be made to be serfs because Christ has set everyone free. And they said they would submit to correction by Scripture. Now, Luther said in response that the peasants may have had a point with regard to calling their own pastors, provided they would then support those pastors. But in general, he said they were turning Christian freedom into a temporal and external thing. He himself disclaimed qualifications for deciding about things like hunting and fishing and rents and taxes, but he did chide the peasants for threatening violence. The mere fact that they were the first to take up arms was very telling in Luther's book. And he said, in general, that their articles had less to do with the gospel and more to do with getting freedom for themselves and their property.
Now, in 1525, Luther wrote an admonition to peace. He directs this at both the princes and the peasants. What did he say?
Well, let me quote you a little bit of what he wrote to the princes. "We have no one on earth to thank for this mischievous rebellion except you. You do nothing but flay and rob your subjects until the poor common people can bear it no longer. The sword is at your throats. It is not the peasants, dear lords, who are resisting you. It is God himself. To make your sin still greater, some of you are beginning to blame this affair on the gospel. If it is still possible to give you advice, try kindness first. For you do not know what God wills to do, and do not strike a spark that could kindle all Germany." Luther wanted the authorities, no less than the peasants, to mind their P's and Q's and to preserve the peace.
So other than what you've told us before here about Luther's thoughts on the peasants, what did he have to say to them in that writing?
Yeah, in an admonition to peace, I'll quote you again something what Luther said to the peasants. "You too must have a care that you take up your cause with a good conscience and with justice. I beg you, in a kind and brotherly way, not to believe all kinds of spirits and preachers, now that Satan has raised up many evil spirits of disorder and of murder. I have never drawn the sword, nor desired revenge. You want to help the gospel, and do not see that by what you are doing, you are hindering it and holding it down in the highest degree. Luther is concerned that the peasants are kind of hijacking the gospel message for their own purposes."
So what happened out of all of this? What did Luther do?
Well, he spent some time in late April and early May of 1525, when things were really coming to a boil, riding around the countryside, urging the peasants to keep the peace. And he did not meet with a very warm reception, to say the least. He found himself actually heckled and rejected. Then, on May 5th, Frederick the Wise, Luther's prince and protector, died. About that same time, and with the tide of peasant violence rising, Luther wrote another short piece, get the title of this one, against the robbing and murdering hordes of peasants. It was a sharp piece, and he thought it had to be sharp. He was horrified at the great loss of nerve on the part of the political authorities. Even Frederick the Wise, on his deathbed, had been hoping for a negotiated peace with the peasants, but after what Luther had seen, he didn't see how negotiation stood much of a chance.
So what specifically did he say in this new writing?
Well, he talked about how rebellion lays a land waste. He mentioned that the peasants had really violated their own loyalty oaths to their God-given rulers. And he noted that they robbed and murdered under the cloak of Christ's name. So he urged that the peasants had to be stopped by force, the way you would have to kill a mad dog.
What happened then? I mean, in Luther's part of Germany, what happened with regard to the Peasants' War?
Well, on May 14th, Thomas Münzer and about 8,000 peasants faced a princely army that was only about half as large by numbers of men, but much better equipped than they were. And contrary to Münzer's claims, no, his sleeves did not stop any bullets. Eventually, Münzer was found hiding in a bed. By the end of that month, May 1525, Münzer was dead. The war was over, at least there. But now the princes went after the currently defenseless peasants with blood in their eyes. And this was just about the time when Luther's little book, Against the Robbing and Murdering Hordes of Peasants, was being widely distributed. People looked at this thing under those circumstances and got the impression that Luther was really kicking the defeated peasants now that they were down.
Now, this raises a question of how the Peasants' War affects Luther's reputation then and now and even to this day. How has this war been understood in the modern world?
Well, see, some people think of Luther in the mid-1520s as kind of making a calculated decision. Which of his supporters is he going to let down? The princes who had protected him, or the common people who had stood with him? And Luther sold out the common people. Marxist scholarship of the Reformation has perennially looked upon the Peasants' War as a major turning point in history. This kind of interpretation says that Luther failed to seize his great opportunity to lead the common people in a massive uprising. When the peasants failed and the princes won, the seeds of modern capitalism were planted. Münzer was the man of the future, but the time was not ripe, and he lost. That kind of Marxist interpretation of the Reformation assumes that any theological debates or religious issues were more or less a front. The really important factors driving events were material and economic. Now, another view of the Peasants' War, it's not Marxist, it's a good deal more romantic, allows that the peasants were serious about religious matters, but still, their loss in the war brought about the end of the spontaneous movement for reform. The Reformation as a spontaneous popular movement kind of ends here, this theory says. That had the effect, in turn, of putting the princes in the driver's seat from then on and taking Germany in the direction, both short-term and long-term, of government absolutism. Now notice that this view also has very little to say about theology. It downplays Reformation theologians, certainly downplays Reformation theology if it notices it at all. Or take another interpretation by an American theologian, Walter Rauschenbusch, the founder of the social gospel. He actually said something quite similar. He said that the glorious years of the Lutheran Reformation were 1517 to 1525, at a time when Luther was speaking for a nation alert to the full range of human problems. And this rising revolutionary tide swept every class and raised all boats. The problem was, on Rauschenbusch's view, that Luther eventually feared the very spirit he had helped to unleash. He came to distrust the common people and disavowed their cause. So Luther ended up siding with the princes and their wealth, and the princes won. But now Rauschenbusch said the social gospel was going to do things differently. Basically, he said the social gospel was going to do what Luther should have done in the first place.
Now, Luther actually does speak for himself on this matter. In a short piece, an open letter on the harsh book against the peasants, what does he say there?
Yeah, he published this shortly after that harsh book against the peasants. He did not apologize for rejecting rebellion, but he did take the princes to task for their brutality. Now that the troublemakers were gone, now that the mayhem had died down, Luther exhorted the rulers to show mercy, to address injustices and grievances where they could. So far as Luther was concerned, there was plenty enough blame to go around. Terrible as the princes had been, though, Luther still warned against a sentimentality that keeps political officials from fulfilling their responsibility to maintain order. In fact, Luther thought that the entire war showed just what happens when the so-called two kingdoms are confused. And Luther was going to remember that lesson.
We're talking about Martin Luther and the Reformation, part 16 of our series with Dr. Ken Cherb on that, the Peasants' War and Luther's Marriage. When we come back, what Luther had been writing and had written about the marriage of clergy and monks and nuns leading up to our discussion of his own marriage. Dr. Ken Cherb is our guest. You know, the Reformation advanced and continues to advance today largely in the hearth and in the home, where parents teach their children the faith by the very design of the reformer Martin Luther and his small catechism, that parents, the heads of the household, ought to teach their children at home the truths of the Christian faith, the Ten Commandments, the Creed, the Lord's Prayer, baptism, absolution, the Lord's Supper. That is at the very heart of the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March, Teaching the Faith at Home. What does this mean? How is this done? Find it at our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or order Teaching the Faith at Home from Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040.
Do you dread going to work out? Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
You've enjoyed our Looking Forward to Sunday Morning interviews with Pastor David Peterson. Did you know that there's a book with more than 60 of his Lent and Easter sermons, including daily readings for all of Lent? It's called Thy Kingdom Come. Find out more and purchase it online at emmanuelpress.us. Make Thy Kingdom Come part of your devotional life during the Lenten and Easter seasons. emmanuelpress.us. Thy Kingdom Come by Pastor David Peterson.
The 27th Annual Congress on the Lutheran Confessions, sponsored by the ACL and Luther Academy, is April 6th through the 8th in Bloomington, Minnesota. The Confessional Lutherans for Christ's Commission will present two seminars. On Tuesday, April 5th, Pastor Rob Jarvis offers an overview of the Reformation and our confessions. On Wednesday, April 6th, Pastor Jeremiah Johnson presents Catechesis Begins in the Home, Practical Ways to Pass on the Faith to Our Children. Learn more at theclcc.org.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The means of grace are the very thing that evangelicals are looking for.
Chris Roseborough talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And so in my presentation, we will talk about some of the alternative means of grace that evangelicals have created in their quest to find some kind of certainty of their own salvation. But then we will then explore back and look at what God's Word says regarding baptism, the Lord's Supper, as well as holy absolution as the means by which, you know, these are outside of us, that God gives us signs and assurance that we are forgiven and in Him and have a right standing with Him.
You can meet and hear Chris Roseborough making the case for the means of grace June 10th and 11th at the 2016 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the Peasants' War and turning to the subject of Luther's marriage. Dr. Ken Cherb is our guest. He has a PhD in history from Ohio State University, formerly served as a theology professor at Concordia University, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Ken, as we get to 1525 here and turning to kind of the theological framework for Luther's marriage, Luther had already written a lot about marriage. Marriage of the clergy, of monks, of nuns. What had he said so far?
In 1520, he wrote to the Christian nobility of the German nation, and there he said, for crying out loud, let the clergy marry. The next year, 1521, in On Monastic Vows, he said, godless vows are not to be kept. Monastic vows run contrary to the word of God, and they are against faith. Prohibiting marriage is, as St. Paul put it, a doctrine of demons. Then the next year, 1522, he writes a little book called The Estate of Marriage, where he points to God's command and ordinance from the first chapter of Genesis, be fruitful and multiply. Accordingly, Luther wrote that as you cannot solemnly promise that you will not be a man or a woman, and if you should make such a promise, it would be foolishness and of no avail, since you cannot make yourself something other than you are. So you cannot promise that you will not produce seed or multiply, unless you fall into one of the categories of eunuchs mentioned by Jesus in Matthew 19. That is, those who are impotent, the castrates, or those spiritually rich and exalted persons, Luther says, who could marry, but prefer instead to concentrate on building the kingdom of heaven. So, Luther concluded, priests, nuns, and monks are duty-bound to forsake their vows whenever they find that God's ordinance to produce seed and multiply is powerful and strong within them.
Now, this is serious business. One is duty-bound to forsake vows, and was rather characteristic of Luther, not only that he wrote such words, but also actually helped people to get out of their cloisters, to get married, especially the nuns. Tell us about these escaped nuns he helped a year after he wrote those words. What was it in 1523?
Yeah, in the spring of 1523, Luther actually was in on a kind of a jailbreak by some nuns. He helped to engineer the rescue of 12 of them from a Cistercian convent. A respected merchant in Torgau by the name of Leonard Kopp used to deliver herring to the convent. Well, that particular time, on that return trip, he took with him 12 nuns. He bundled them into the back of his covered wagon as if they were empty barrels for hauling the fish. Now, 9 of these 12 escaped nuns ended up in Wittenberg seeking refuge, and Luther pitched in to try to find good husbands for these former nuns.
Now, Luther wasn't looking to get married himself, was he?
No. While at the Wartburg, he had said that nobody was going to give him a wife. And later on, he reflected and said that if somebody had told him there at Worms in 1521 that within a few years he himself would be married, he never would have believed it. Well, Luther was still thinking along these very same lines as the middle of the 1520s came around. In 1524, he wrote to his friend, the elector's secretary, George Spalatin, and he said, according to my present frame of mind, I have no intention of marrying. Not that I am insensible to the emotions of the flesh, being neither wood nor stone, but because I have no desire to, and daily expect to die a heretic's death. However, I shall not limit the power of the Lord working in me, nor depend on the stability of my own heart.
Now, that power would eventually work through Catherine von Bora. Who is she?
Catherine von Bora was one of those nuns who got away from the Cistercian convent in 1523 and ended up at Wittenberg. By 1525, now a couple years later, places had been found for the rest of these former nuns, some of them by Luther himself, mostly places with new husbands. But there was still no match for Catherine. She was 26 years old. That made her a bit older than the others. And there had been some attempts. There were a couple of plans for suitors for her that just did not work out. One was by the suitor's choice. The other was by Catherine's own choice. And now in 1525, she just lets it be known that she would be willing to get married to Luther or to his friend and colleague, and by the way, exact contemporary, Nicholas von Amsdorff.
Did Luther consider it?
Well, yeah, he did, with some urging from his father. In May of 1525, now remember, May 1525 is when the Peasants' War crisis is at its absolute height. Luther there in Wittenberg is letting it be known that he would marry Catherine. Suddenly, Luther wrote to a friend, and while my mind was on other matters, you can imagine the peasants alone gave him a lot to think about, the Lord has snared me with the yoke of marriage. Catherine was a handsome woman of noble descent, but still, some of Luther's friends did not especially like her at first. She had a mind of her own and would speak her own mind. But still, on June 13th, 1525, she was betrothed to Luther. Catherine, or as Luther would call her, Katie. On June 13th, it was a small ceremony, a simple circle of friends. 2 weeks later, there was a larger social event, and now everybody knew Luther was married.
So why did he get married?
Well, prepare yourself here, Todd, for a distinctly unromantic set of reasons, as Luther gave them. He said he got married to please his father, who wanted to pass on the family name. He also said he got married despite the Pope. And he wanted to make a positive testimony that marriage is good for all. He wrote that by getting married, he made the angels laugh and the devils weep. He also wrote, "I wanted to confirm what I have taught by practicing it, for I find so many timid people, in spite of such great light from the gospel. God has willed and brought forth this action, for I am not in love or burning with desire, but I do love my wife," he said.
He did love her, didn't he?
Yes. They ended up having 6 children, 2 of whom died young, and that was about the average for the time. About 1/3 of children died in childhood. Really, in a profound way, Todd, June of 1525 is an important date. It is kind of the birth of the Protestant parsonage. And this is a key point as regards, for example, Luther's later work on Christian education in general and the catechisms in particular. For the first time in centuries, in Latin Christendom, here was a major theologian and pastor working on explaining the faith to children while he himself had his own children right under his nose there at home. Now, the importance of that fact and what it meant for teaching the faith in the home and in church can hardly be overstated.
Luther also grew very dependent on his wife in some extraordinary ways. Tell us about those.
Well, Katie managed the house for Luther while he was busy with preaching and teaching and writing, and this was no mean feat. The house, in this case, was the former Augustinian monastery in Wittenberg, the place where Luther himself had lived as a friar. Now called Luther House, it was the place where there was almost always quite an array of people. I mean, relatives, students, refugees, all sorts of folks that Luther took in or just invited over to eat. Luther himself started gardening to grow food for the household, but Katie, for her part, took on an array of things. She looked after an orchard, a fish pond, and a barnyard where she did the slaughtering herself. She also brewed beer. Luther once quipped, "Kate pays the bills." And the way Luther handled money, that is, not keeping very careful track of it and always willing to give it away, Kate pretty much had to pay the bills. When Luther got married to Katie, the Archbishop of Mainz sent them a present of 10 gold gulden. And Luther told Katie to return the gift. She did no such thing. She kept the money, and she brought it out later, the first time that there was sore need. All in all, then, Luther married well, even if just about everything connected with his marriage was unexpected, including its timing around the time of the Peasants' War.
When we come back, 10 more minutes with Dr. Ken Scherr, part 16 of our weekly series on Martin Luther and the Reformation. A few summarizing thoughts. We'll talk about how Luther, when teaching others to teach their children, was teaching his own children. He had a family as well. In the second hour of the program on this Tuesday, we'll be hearing Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, making the case for confessional Lutheranism in the 21st century from the 2014 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We'll be right back.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Do you wish your Lutheran school offered Latin, Greek, or logic? What about German or calculus? Right now, local Lutheran schools in two different states are utilizing Wittenberg Academy to expand their course offerings. Whether it's Latin for third graders or logic for seniors in high school, Wittenberg Academy can help. For your homeschooler or for your brick-and-mortar Lutheran school, we have solutions. To find out more, visit WittenbergAcademy.org.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. St. Paul's Lutheran, Coleman, Alabama. Faith Lutheran, Waterloo, Iowa. Emmanuel Lutheran, Everett, Washington. Lake George Lutheran Chapel, Fremont, Indiana. Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran, Snohomish, Washington. Faith Lutheran, Buford, South Carolina, Trinity Lutheran, Great Falls, Montana, Mount Calvary Lutheran, Westview, Pennsylvania, St. Paul Lutheran, International Falls, Minnesota, Redeemer Lutheran, Marshalltown, Iowa, Trinity and Grace Lutheran, Bear Creek, Wisconsin, St. Paul Lutheran, Sevierville, Tennessee, Good Shepherd Lutheran, Sherman, Illinois, and Zion Lutheran, Dexter, Iowa. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. The Issues Etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about Martin Luther and the Reformation, the 16th part in our series with Dr. Ken Scherb, pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri. He has a PhD in history from Ohio State University, formerly served as a theology professor at Concordia University in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Ken, as we usually do here in the last few minutes of our conversations, why don't you summarize what we've said so far today?
A large, coordinated uprising of peasants in the mid-1520s was spurred on by theologians such as Thomas Munzer, not by Luther. Although Luther admonished both the princes and the peasants, he firmly rejected all rebellion and sedition, and on theological grounds, he urged the princes to put down that rebellion by the peasants, a position for which he has been criticized for years. And just after the Peasants' War, Luther married a former nun, Catherine von Bora, who became his great domestic manager as well as his beloved wife. Now, Todd, let me turn this around and give you and the audience a few true or false statements. See what you think of these. First one, true or false. The complaints of the peasants were strictly about economic matters. False. The nub of many of their complaints was economic, to be sure. Their meager means of subsistence were shrinking rapidly. But there was a political edge to the peasants' complaints. And theologically, that was also a factor that got mixed in when they said that they should be free from serfdom because Christ has made all men free. Another statement, true or false. Problems with the peasants were pretty much confined to Saxony, where Luther lived. False. These problems were in many German lands, which was part of what made things so very alarming there in 1524 and 1525. And further, the great peasant uprising of this time was hardly unique. I mean, there were more than 60 peasant uprisings in mid and southwest German lands through the late 15th century on into the early 16th century. This one was bigger, it was better coordinated, but it was not a new phenomenon, and it was not confined to any particular place. Another statement, true or false. Luther disapproved of all the peasant demands. False. Luther said the peasants might have had a point with regard to calling their own pastors, provided they would then support those pastors. In general, though, he did take exception to the way he said they were turning Christian freedom into a temporal and external thing. He said he was not qualified, nor was it his place to decide things like hunting and fishing and rents and taxes, but he did chide the peasants for threatening to get their way by violence. Another statement, true or false. Luther threw his lot in with the princes against the peasants. Just as it's stated there, that is false. Luther criticized the princes too. Now, some interpreters of the Reformation have made much of the fact that Luther did support the princes in the battle against the peasants, but at the time, Luther thought he really had a duty to kind of strengthen the weak knees of the governing authorities, because he did not see a great willingness on their part to stand up to the peasant rebellion. His main reasons for opposing the peasants were theological, that they were rebelling against the authorities God had placed over them, and in the process, they were misusing and discrediting the gospel by making it out to be about purely temporal blessings. After the war, though, he criticized the princes all over again for their cruelty, and even kind of let it be known that there will come a time when he would write more about the princes. Another statement, true or false. Luther thought the entire war showed what happens when the so-called two kingdoms are confused. That is true. And this is a lesson that Luther takes on with him into the subsequent years. One more statement for you, Todd, true or false. Luther got married to a former nun, just as he had intended to do from the time he himself had left the cloister. False. Luther did marry a former nun, but this was not what he had been intending. He himself was surprised by his marriage, which turned out, though, to be a good marriage and the birthplace of the Protestant parsonage.
Ken, I want to return to two points you made before in the few minutes that are left to us. First of all, we've got kind of three characters here that have emerged through this time and in this great tumultuous time, especially in Wittenberg. We've got Luther himself. We've got Karlstadt. We've mentioned him before. And then we have this Thomas Munzer. How would you lay them side by side?
Yeah, in very broad terms, and this is very broad, and by the way, this is not an original thought with me. I read it first in an article by a theologian and historian named Carter Lindbergh. He said that Luther's approach to reform and approach to ministry could be summed up as a ministry of the Word, where the meeting of God and man comes on the level of man. That is to say, God comes to us with his grace, with his incarnate Son, with his Word and sacraments, where we are. Karlstadt, by comparison, was thinking of the meeting of God and man more on God's level, where we have to become more and more like God, where we have to become more and more obedient. Karlstadt stressed regeneration of the Christian, and he stressed the law. So if Luther was promoting a ministry of the gospel, Karlstadt, more a ministry of the law. And then Munzer, kind of taking Karlstadt and going even further, promoted the ministry of the Spirit. He wanted a pure, absolutely pure and holy church and society. This is kind of a difference of degree with Karlstadt, not a difference of kind, but a huge difference of degree, to the point where nothing was good enough for Munzer, and rebellion turned out to be the answer to the whole thing. Once again, with Munzer, the meeting between God and sinful men comes more on the level of God as we try to rise with the Spirit to that level. So with Munzer, it's the Spirit that characterizes everything. So you have Luther with the gospel, Karlstadt with the law, Munzer with the Spirit. And really, Todd, in many ways, that's a good paradigm for looking at ministry today. I mean, think of the people whose ministry, think of the churches, the denominations whose ministries are characterized by a strict adherence to law or a strict calling upon the Spirit to do things that the Word itself cannot be counted upon to do. And what gets lost in the process is justification by grace through faith.
And then with about 2 minutes here, you had mentioned that Luther is, and you just hinted at it, he's kind of putting together his pedagogy, his catechetical form. But he's not doing it in a vacuum, as we sometimes imagine. He's doing it with kids at home, with a wife at home. You said you really have the man who's trying to do this while he's also trying to instruct others in doing it. What are your thoughts there with about a minute and a half?
We talked before about how Luther, early on in the 1520s, had kind of ducked the whole thought of preparing a catechism. He knew it had to be done. He thought it was important. He was trying to urge others to do it. But he kept saying, no, I've got other things. And, of course, he did have other things to be working on. Our discussion today with the Peasants' War and the marriage, at just the same time he's writing the hymns and all that stuff, I mean, it all came to a head. He didn't have the time, and maybe that's a good thing. Providentially, it's a good thing. Luther did not start working on the catechism until he did have his own wife and his own kids at home. And that makes a huge difference. Any pastor who's had to talk to kids, like I do chapel for preschool kids who are 3 and 4 years old, that is a tremendous exercise for me in keeping the gospel plain and simple for the very youngest people. In fact, when Luther had kids of his own, his use of the biblical picture of God as Father increased in the frequency of his using it in his work and in the drama with which he used it.
Dr. Ken Sherb is pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri. He has a PhD in history from Ohio State University, formerly served as a theology professor at Concordia University, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Ken, thank you again.
Good to be with you, Todd. We'll talk to you soon.
Dr. Ken Sherb is a great guest, and he's a great historical scholar. He began both his scholarly and his pastoral training as a 1988 graduate of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. If you're interested in the vocation of pastor or deaconess, contact them, ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu. Give them a call, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155. Forming servants in Jesus Christ to teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all. Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. When we come back, we're going to hear Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, make the case for confessional Lutheranism in the 21st century. We're going to play his presentation from the 2014 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Hour 2 of Issues Etc. on this Tuesday afternoon. I'm Todd Wilkin, Hour 2 in 5 minutes.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
What makes Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, Illinois so special? Our new members talk about the family atmosphere, the welcoming people, and the outstanding music. But most importantly, you'll be confronted with your sin and comforted with the assurance that Jesus has removed that sin so that you can live each day as His baptized and forgiven child. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church is at 612 North State Street in Freeburg, Illinois. Sunday worship is at 9 a.m. Sunday school and Bible classes at 10:20 a.m. Call 618-539-5664.
Have you recently graduated from high school or college and are still making up your mind about your future career? Here's an opportunity to serve your neighbor through an extended, uniquely Lutheran service program. It's called the Lutheran Youth Corps. Find out more about the Lutheran Youth Corps at lcms.org/youthcorps. Life together through witness and mercy, the Lutheran Youth Corps. lcms.org/youthcorps.
Do you long for a church that has ancient roots and yet contemporary significance, that is at once Catholic, Orthodox, Evangelical, and Protestant? Welcome to the Lutheran Church. We're what you've been looking for. Find a church near you that preaches and teaches the faith once for all delivered to the saints at issuesetc.org.